Schopenhauer believes that our will to live is the key for solving the riddle of existence. We all experience the will to live firsthand. It's the source of the pain and suffering of our existence. To Schopenhauer, the concept of the will is central to his metaphysics, his attempt to describe the ultimate nature of reality. But the will is also important in the two other areas of philosophy that especially interest him: aesthetics, the study of art and its role in human experience, and ethics, the study of the principles of human conduct. Though aesthetics and ethics are important in themselves, philosophers usually consider them to be subservient to the study of metaphysics. This is because our answers to the general problems of existence determine how we approach its particular aspects, and Schopenhauer's ideas in aesthetics and ethics certainly follow from his central ideas about the nature of the world. Schopenhauer presents his philosophy of the will mainly as an answer to certain problems of human existence, problems that were especially prominent in his day and age. But his philosophy is also related to earlier philosophical systems. Schopenhauer studied under Fichte at the University of Berlin, but he saw himself as following in the footsteps of Kant, going in a direction opposed to Fichte. Let's briefly examine the Kantian ideas that Schopenhauer inherited. Schopenhauer believed Kant was a great philosopher because he distinguished between the world of sense experience and the world as it is in itself. On the one hand are the appearances of everyday commonplace experience. On the other hand is the reality behind them. Though Kant built this idea into a major philosophical system, the basic distinction had also been made in Plato's major work, The Republic. Plato contrasted the objects of sense experience, which change continually, with the unchanging objects of reality, which the mind alone can grasp. Schopenhauer approvingly refers to Plato's famous myth of the cave, which depicts the sorry state of our unenlightened experience. This myth conveys the idea that our senses present us only with appearances, not with truth or knowledge.
He says that men, firmly chained in a dark cave, see neither the genuine original light nor actual things, but only the inadequate light of the fire in the cave, and the shadows of actual things passing by the fire behind their backs. Yet they imagine that the shadows are the reality, and that determining the succession of these shadows is true wisdom.
Like Plato, Kant believed that we experience only a world of appearances. But unlike Plato, Kant believed that we have knowledge of the world of appearances. This knowledge is possible because the mind actively influences what we experience. It organizes experience into categories, enabling us to understand that experience. Space, for example, is one of the mind's categories that organizes our sense experience. We see objects in space. Kant, in his Critique of Pure Reason, emphasizes that space is a form of our sensibility, not a property of the objects themselves.
The transcendental concept of appearances in space is a critical reminder that nothing intuited in space is a thing in itself, that space is not a form inhering in things in themselves as their intrinsic property, that objects in themselves are quite unknown to us, and that what we call outer objects are nothing but mere representations of our sensibility, the form of which is space.
Since the mind stands between us and the world as it exists in itself eludes our intellectual grasp. We know nothing of the nature of this hidden world apart from our perception of it. In Kant's words,
the true correlate of sensibility, the thing in itself, is not known and cannot be known through these representations. And in experience, no question is ever asked in regard to it.
Thinking of an optical illusion may help clarify Kant's distinction between appearances and the thing in itself. A stick placed in water appears bent when in reality it's straight. Here we can readily distinguish between appearance and reality because we can see the stick both in the water and out of the water. But in the former distinction between the world of appearances and the thing in itself, we never have the opportunity to see the world both ways. The mind organizes experience into its own categories, so we can't experience the world as it is before our mind influences it. Schopenhauer thinks this revelatory distinction is the outstanding achievement of Kantian philosophy. Kant had called his work critical philosophy because it fundamentally criticized traditional concepts of reason, causation, and reality. Schopenhauer begins with Kant's critical philosophy. Indeed, he sees himself as the only one among his contemporaries who remains true to Kant's insights. Kant, at the end of his book, Prolegomena to Any Future Metaphysics, prophetically described the attitude of a convert to critical philosophy. This was to be Schopenhauer's attitude towards his contemporaries after he was won over to that view.
This much is certain, that whoever has once tasted critique will be ever after disgusted with all dogmatic twaddle, which he formerly had to put up with because his reason had to have something and could find nothing better for its support.
Schopenhauer, having entered the promised land of critical philosophy, is incredulous that other philosophers have ignored or discarded Kant's work. Schopenhauer frequently criticizes Fichte because Fichte rejects Kant's notion of the thing in itself. Fichte, whose central category of reality is the thinking self, dismisses the thing in itself as an invention. The thing in itself, he holds, has no reality whatever. It doesn't occur in nature. The system of experience is nothing other than thinking accompanied by the feeling of necessity. Since Schopenhauer starts with the thing in itself, it's understandable that Kant, not Fichte, is his philosophical mentor. But Schopenhauer emphasizes that Kant's philosophy is a point of departure, not a destination.
People generally are beginning to be conscious that real and serious philosophy still stands where Kant left it. In any case, I cannot see that anything has been done in philosophy between him and me. I therefore take my direct departure from him.
With Schopenhauer, the distinction between the world of appearances and the thing in itself evolves into the view that the world has a twofold nature. On the one hand, the world is appearance, representation. On the other hand, the world is will. We might easily be misled into supposing that Schopenhauer develops a two-world view. Instead, he argues that there are two basic aspects to the world, representation and will. Representation is visible appearance, and will is hidden reality. These two aspects of the world together exhaust the nature of the world and human experience. Schopenhauer breaks decisively from Kant when he identifies the unknowable thing in itself with the will. By declaring the nature of the thing in itself to be the will, Schopenhauer thinks he's revitalized the notion of the thing in itself. Schopenhauer argues that a Kantian thing in itself, which is neither representation nor will, is an empty delusion. In Schopenhauer's words, Kant's idea of the thing in itself is an ignis fatuus, a fatuous idea.
This will alone constitutes the other aspect of the world. For this world is, on the one side, entirely representation, just as, on the other, it is entirely will. But a reality that is neither of these two, but an object in itself, into which also Kant's thing in itself has unfortunately degenerated in his hands, is the phantom of a dream, and its acceptance is an ignis fatuus in philosophy.